Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Blonde Cargo by Fred McIsaac, Part 1, Panama Puzzle. His name on the first cabin passenger list was Addison Francis Murphy, and that was all anybody knew about him, except that he spent most of his time in a deck chair on the promenade deck with a volume of the Encyclopedia Britannica open on his lap. He was not a good-looking man, either. Neither was he bad-looking, and he was fairly young. The situation upon the Delphian, bound from Los Angeles to New York via Panama, was, as usual, an abundance of pretty girls, quantities of doddering grayheads, and a few youths who hadn't been using a razor long enough to become expert in its management. During the first couple of days, nobody noticed Mr. Murphy, but after that he was remarked upon because he made no acquaintances, apparently did not wish to make any. Anyone who knew Addison Francis Murphy knew that he was not unsocial, so there must have been good reason for his making a man of mystery of himself. It was really quite simple. Murphy, after purchasing a first-class ticket and laying aside the necessary sum needed for shipboard tipping, was practically without funds. Acquaintances beget expense. Enough said. When the ship arrived in New York, Murphy would walk ashore more or less penniless, but that did not bother him a jot or tittle, whatever they are, for Murphy was reasonably certain that wherever newspapers were published, he could manage to land a job. The ship's purser, whose name was Fitzgibbon, was a fellow with an insatiable curiosity. On the third day, he dropped into the deck chair beside the student and said, "Look here, Murphy, what's eating you? Look at all the pretty girls. They want dancing partners and swimming partners and people to flirt with. You're a young fellow. Close that damn book and do your duty." Murphy returned his Irish grin with another equally broad. He said, "Wherever you go, you'll find girls, but this is the first time I ever had 36 volumes of the Britannica in 18 days to read them. It is full of the most interesting information. Try it sometime." The purser rose. "You're a nut," he said disgustedly. "I'm going to believe what I believe, and not be looking through fine print." "Who is that man going by with the pretty blonde?" asked Murphy. "Name of Beckett. John C. Beckett. Owns a string of horses. He's bought more champagne than anybody on the ship. I still don't like him. Cut him out with a blonde. Name's Vivian Darcy. Her old man owns all the copper in Montana. What do you do for a living?" "Newspaper reporter. Not working." "Well, I'll be seeing you," said the purser. "I'll introduce you to Miss Darcy if you like. Matter of fact, she told me to bring you round. I have 28 volumes to read yet. No time." "Bah," said the disgusted purser. It became very warm on the third day out. The sea was like a sheet of shimmering blue glass, the sky like a cerulean dome, unflecked by a single cloud. Porpoises put in an appearance, and so did purple blazers and flannel pants and light dresses. Owning only the blue serge suit, which he wore, and the plain black shoes in his feet, Addison Francis Murphy did not make any change in his costume. He stopped wearing his old gray felt hat, and his stiff reddish hair was revealed to be much in need of tonsural attention. The sun burned his face to the color of rare old brick. He was putting on weight. His body was becoming, as it usually suggested when well fed, a slap. In his quiet way, he was enjoying himself and was already up to K in the encyclopedia. It was six spells of the afternoon watch when the next deck chair was suddenly occupied by a beautiful young blonde with dancing blue eyes and a divine smile. She wore a sea-green sweater, a white linen skirt, and snub-nosed sports shoes that still couldn't make her feet look big. "What's the matter with you, Mr. Murphy?" she asked impudently. She was impudent because she had never met the gentleman. Murphy glanced up and smiled at her. For the first time, she had a chance to see that he had fine white teeth. "Why, I'm fine," he said pleasantly. "You're Miss Darcy, aren't you?" "Fancy your knowing my name," she exclaimed. "I've heard people addressing you as Miss Darcy." "Well, why have you been avoiding me?" she demanded with a saucy smile. "You are the only man on board who hasn't danced with me." "I've got a sore foot," he said untruthfully. "No, you just don't like me," she stated dolefully. "I think you're swell. I'm reading a very interesting article in Kalamazoo. Do you know anything about Kalamazoo?" "No, thank heaven," she said tartly. "If you think I came here to flirt with you, it shows how conceited men are. I want you to give me $5. I'm collecting a fund for prizes for the masquerade." "I'm sorry," said with some embarrassment. "I don't like masquerades, and I don't think the right people ever get the prizes, and I can't afford to contribute $5. "You're just being mean," she said with a pout. "Economical. I'm on a budget. There's nothing in it regarding masquerade contributions." She rose. "Well, Mr. Murphy," she said acidly, "in my opinion, you're a complete washout. Good afternoon." She departed gracefully, though in dudgeon. Mercy gazed after her with regret. The following morning, the ship arrived at Mazatlan, down in the southwest corner of Mexico, and the passengers piled into the tender and went ashore for a gay day. Murphy leaned on the rail and watched them depart. He would have liked to go ashore, but a day in Mazatlan was not included in his budget. The purser stepped up beside him. "Read the bulletin about the new treaty between the United States and Panama?" "Yep. What of it?" "We've relinquished our right to dictate the foreign policy of the Republic. We've paid them off and told them to roll their own hoop." "I got that. What of it?" "It means that there will be trouble down there. Revolution, plots, and such. They'll get cocky, knowing that the Marines won't use their clubs in the shadow of the capital, and our passengers will have to behave as if they really were in a foreign country." "Can't get drunk and beat up the natives with your former impunity?" "Right. Why don't you go ashore, just like everybody else?" "I figure on going through the J's in the encyclopedia." "You're a queer egg," said the purser with a laugh, and strolled away. A moment later, a page boy touched his arm. "Telegram just came aboard for you, Mr. Murphy, at the purser's office." Murphy strolled to the main companion, descended to the deck, and collected the telegram. He controlled his surprise, although he expected no messages. "Greetings, Rambler," the telegram began. "Wire if you'll open office for Round World Press Association, Panama. 75 a week. New setup down there. Learn from Los Angeles correspondent you sailed on Delphian." It was signed Wallace, New York. His impulse was to wire refusal and go back to the 36 volumes. What influenced him to do otherwise was vanity. If he took this job, the $15 he had allotted for expenses between Panama and New York would be velvet. He could tell the Darcy girl he had been joshing about the masquerade contribution and that his sore foot had got well. He'd stick around Panama for a couple of months, resign and continue on to New York. And he might as well, under the changed circumstances, go ashore in Mazatlan. He went down to his cabin, secured his hat, and asked the steward where he took the tender. "Go all the way aft along this alley," said the steward. "Go down 2 flights to D deck at the companionway you come to. Turn left and you'll see the open port where the gangway is." He followed directions as well as he could, not being very familiar with the interior of big passenger ships, but turned right at the foot of the stairs on the D deck instead of left, followed a corridor with an open door leading out on deck, and emerged upon a part of the ship he hadn't even known existed. It was a covered promenade deck that ran to the stern. There were no deck chairs but many benches, and upon the benches sat girls, some of them pretty and all of them blondes. He whistled softly. He became aware of a number of pair of bright eyes inspecting him curiously, and he spoke to a steward who happened along. "What's this? Tourist accommodations?" "No, sir, steerage. The tourists have much better quarters than these. You see, we don't often have many steerage passengers on these ships. We put other ones up in quarters near the bow on the voyage on account of having all these actresses."
"Actresses?" he exclaimed.
"Sure. They're going to work in an American show in Panama City." The steward passed on. Murphy met the clear blue eyes of a girl in a yellow wash dress, sitting on a bench a dozen feet away. She smiled at him. "Hello, Redney," she said huskily. "Got a cigarette?" He grinned and produced a package of cigarettes. He sat down on the bench beside the better to light the weed. He inspected her sharply. She wore no stockings, and her black slippers were shabby and run down at the heels.
The dress she had on could be bought on Geary Street, San Francisco, for 49 cents, he thought. His fingers touched the palm of her hand, which was rough and calloused. Her face, however, was round, soft, and pretty. Her hair was thick and naturally yellow. "How'd you like the sea voyage?" she asked. "The sea is okay," she told him. "But the chuck is vile, and the rooms are down in the bottom of the boat. Some of us have been sleeping on deck. Come down and see us sometime."
"Are you a member of this troop?"
"Me? Oh, yeah."
"They don't look like actresses very much, except you, of course."
"Actresses, huh?"
"A lot of clucks. I'm the only one with stage experience. And I ain't had a job for 4 years. I've been walloping pots in a snide hotel in Frisco. Any kind of a ride looked good to me. Say, what's it like up on them top decks?"
"A bit more luxurious. If these girls haven't any stage experience, how do they expect to appear in a musical show in Panama?"
She laughed loudly. "Well, now, Clarence, Mama isn't worrying about that. They get us cheap because they got to train us. The manager says them South Americans are crazy about blondes, and so we don't have to be performers. All we have to do is be blondes."
"How many of you are there?"
32.
"A big troop."
"Yeah, that's why we have to travel tourist instead of first class."
"Do you think you're traveling tourist?" he asked, surprised.
"Certainly. Ain't we?"
He shook his head. "Steerage."
"Ain't that the same thing?"
"Well, not quite."
"Put something over on us, did they?" she said vindictively. "Say, can you spare that pack of smokes? I ain't got a dime to buy any."
"You mean you didn't get an advance?"
"They bought our tickets, and they pay the tips. Our dough doesn't start to come in till we get to Panama."
He handed her the cigarettes.
"What kind of work have these girls been doing?" he asked.
"Chambermaids, hash slingers, manicures, and a lot of them come out of canning factories." Murphy was inspecting those with range of his eyes. Few of them were really pretty. Most of them were girls with heavy features, thick ankles, and large feet. They would satisfy Panama audiences, perhaps, but they couldn't get by in the United States.
"What's your name?" she demanded.
"Murphy, what's yours?"
She giggled.
"O'Brien."
"Same breed of goats, huh?"
He grinned, then eyes narrowed as a man came out of a companion entrance and moved in the Rambler's direction. His appearance caused a commotion amongst the girls. They surrounded him. They demanded cigarettes and beer. Why couldn't they go ashore, like the other passengers? He pushed them aside and bore down upon the couple on the bench.
"Who's this guy, huh?" he demanded truculently of Miss O'Brien.
Miss O'Brien tossed her head impudently. "Friend of mine. Do you mind?" He looked Murphy over.
"Scram guy," he said roughly. "You don't belong down here."
He was a tall, thin man with broad shoulders and a wasp waist. He wore an expensive light blue suit with a belt, Panama hat, and corrugated leather sports shoes.
"Neither do you, Slocum," said Murphy quietly.
The fellow's black brows bent. A look of wonder and then anger spread over his rather good-looking countenance. Recognition now was mutual.
"Scram, O'Brien. I want to talk to this bozo," he growled.
"Her master's voice," said Miss O'Brien satirically. "Come and see us again, handsome." This to Murphy. She retreated in good order. He sat down on the bench.
"You been on this ship from Frisco?"
Murphy shook his head.
"San Diego. I've seen you topside. So you're in show business now, Slocum?"
"That's right. What of it?"
"Nothing. You've a pretty seedy-looking troop."
"Well, we're cheapening, and that's a fact," admitted Mr. Slocum.
"When did you get out of jail, Slocum?"
asked Murphy quietly. The man's face twisted with anger, but when he replied, it was without heat.
"A couple of years ago. I don't bear no hard feeling. He was working for your newspaper, and I got caught in the cleanup in Baltimore."
"Who do you work for now?"
"Taking over the Panama office of the Round World Press," Murphy grinned. "I suppose I'll get press seats for your opening night."
"Oh, sure," declared Slocum.
"Beckett's your money man?"
"What makes you think that?" asked Slocum sharply.
"I've seen you talking to him. Any of the girls in the first cabin that you've been dancing with know about your harem down here?"
"Are you going around shooting off your mouth about this?" demanded Slocum truculently.
"I kind of like that O'Brien kid. I may sneak down here, okay?"
Slocum laughed relievedly.
"Why, sure," he said heartily. "Play the whole field. I ain't wasting my time on these floozies with the fillies there or in first cabin."
Murphy rose.
"I'll be going. Oh, by the way, tell Beckett to keep away from Miss Vivian Darcy. That's important."
Slocum jumped up. He clenched his fist. "Who the hell do you think you are?" he shouted. "Never mind. I'll tell him myself."
"Look here, Murph. Beckett has nothing to do with this enterprise. And if he had, it's legitimate. He's a millionaire. He is. Made his dough in oil. Got a string of racehorses.
Don't let me see him in the vicinity of Miss Darcy Slocum. That's all." Part 2. 32 Blondes. The Rambler went through the opening into the alley, which had led him inadvertently to the steerage promenade deck. Slocum stood looking after him, breathing heavily, fist clenched and muttering aloud. "The sneaking, nosy mug," he muttered. "He had to be on this boat, and he's going to stay in Panama. And Beckett has to keep away from that dame. Well, Mr. Rambler, Murphy, maybe you ain't going to get to Panama. What do you think of that?" But Rambler Murphy was not unaware that he had left behind him a man breathing threats. There had been a time in Baltimore when this same Jack Slocum had engineered a ride for Addison Francis Murphy. He had returned from the ride and sent Slocum up for 5 years. Slocum must have got a couple of years off for good behavior. He located the elevator, rode out to the top of the deck, and entered the radio room. He wrote a radiogram addressed to Joe Wallace, his new employer in New York, which was as follows. "Get me a complete line of activities of John C. Beckett, Sportsman of San Francisco, Cable Care U.S. Consul at Panama, Murphy." Murphy had no further interest in going ashore. He secured a volume of the encyclopedia and resumed his intensive study of the world's history and geography. He was thus engaged when the tenders brought back the passengers full of Mexican liquors and laden with Mexican trinkets. After dinner, there was a dance on deck, and for the first time, Addison Francis Murphy appeared in the gay throng. He was watching for Miss Darcy, and she appeared, for a wonder, alone from the smoke room entrance. Murphy confronted her. "Oh, Miss Darcy," he said, "I wanted to give you the $5 for the masquerade." She lifted her pretty chin, narrowing her pretty eyes. "The books are closed and the names of the contributors sent to the printer," she stated. "I was kidding yesterday," he said with an embarrassed grin. "Indeed, it was the only opportunity you will ever have to kid me, Mr. Murphy," she said. "Kindly let me pass." There was nothing for him to do but to step back, and the girl walked straight into the arms of John C. Beckett, who whirled her out upon the dance floor, which caused Rambler Murphy's Irish blood to boil. A moment later he spied Slocum foxtrotting with a pretty child of 17. He had to walk all the way to the rear end of the first-class promenade to cool his wrath about that. It was dark down there and cooler than up forward where the windows of the promenade deck were closed to protect the young women in their scanty ballroom raiment. Murphy leaned on the rail and looked down at the black water with its fringe of white foam, with his ship's side cut through it like a knife. Someone touched his arm. He looked up. Had Miss Darcy sought him out to apologize for her rudeness? To his astonishment, the O'Brien girl stood beside him. She wore a bright red evening dress, cut daringly low. Her yellow hair was braided tightly around her small head, and she looked beautiful in the semi-darkness. "How on earth did you get up here?" he demanded. She laughed softly. "I figured if you got down to our awful place, I could get up the same way. I put on my evening dress, only got one, and I sailed through that door into the main deck house. A steward stopped me, and I gave him the writs. 'How dare you?' I said, like, 'Lady Vere de Vere.' 'I beg your pardon, mum,' he said, and let me pass. I reckon he thought I was a swell doll who had been slumming. I kept climbing stairs and finally got up here. It's swell, ain't it? Not bad. Say, Slocum knows you, don't he?" Murphy nodded. "Well, the real reason I wanted to get up here was to give you a tip. I heard him talking about you to a guy named Ferguson that's giving us dancing lessons every day. He said he hated your guts, and this ship wasn't big enough to hold you and him." "What did he mean by that?" "What he said, I suppose. I've run up against him before, Miss O'Brien. I know all about him. Aw, call me Kate." "Well, Kate, he's a bad egg. Look out for him." She nodded. Her face wore an expression of anxiety. "You look out for him. Listen, Mr. Murphy, what are us girls up against?" "I don't know. What do you think you're up against?" "Well, I know this show won't ever open. Most of these dames are so dumb they can't be taught anything. Say, a chorus number by them would make even the Spigs die laughing. I'm worried. They must be crazy thinking they can do anything with a flock of clucks like them." Murphy drew forth a pencil and an old envelope. "I'm a newspaper man from way back," he said. "I'm opening an office in Panama for the Round World Press Association. I don't know where I'll locate, but if you get in trouble, go to the American Consul and ask him my address. Here's my full name and the name of the association. You may get in trouble for coming up here. Better go down right away. As he spoke, the band struck up. Looking along the deck, they could see the space reserved for dancing. A multitude of Chinese lanterns made the scene gay, and the bright dresses of the young women made it brilliant. The band was playing The Music Goes Round and Round. "Gee," she said wistfully, "that's my favorite tune. I wish I could only get one dance." He saw tears in the girl's eyes. "Well, why not?" he asked recklessly. "You mean it?" The rambler laughed, took her arm, and led her to the dance floor. "Won't we get in trouble?" "Nah. You're as well dressed and better looking than most of them." In another moment, they were whirling round in time to the music. The dancing space was crowded, but Murphy, though an infrequent dancer, was a good one, and Miss O'Brien was light as a feather. They wove their way in and out, and the rapture of the girl communicated itself to her partner. "I beg your pardon," said a man who had backed into Miss O'Brien. "Keep the change," she said happily. Murphy looked round. It was Beckett, dancing with Vivian Darcy. An expression of astonishment and then wrath spread on his countenance. Murphy encountered the cold blue eyes of Miss Darcy, who looked right through him. "See that guy," Cat said. "He's the boss. He was the one that hired us in Frisco." "Name of Beckett?" "That's him. He can travel up here, but he sticks us down with the freight. Gee, look at the grub, will you?" "Come and have some," suggested the rambler, glad to end the dance. There was an elaborate buffet spread on snowy tables on the far side of the dance floor. There were turkeys, chickens, glazed ham, salads, and ices shaped like fruits and birds and beasts. Kate O'Brien ate like a horse. Murphy, who'd eaten a very hearty dinner, sipped coffee and enjoyed watching the kid eat. Apparently the girl had been half-starved during the voyage. With a deep sigh, she finally ended her amazing consumption of victuals. "Jiminy Cricket," she said, "I never had such a good time in my life." "That's why," he said. "Now, I'll take you back to the steerage. Come along." "Things like this is what makes Bolsheviks," she stated. "Well, I got mine for once. I'm ready to quit." He conducted her along devious passages and left at the door which gave out upon the steerage promenade deck. She put out her hand. "Gee, you're a swell egg," she said, "if I can ever do anything for you." "Good night," he said. "Remember, the American Consul will have my address." He went back to the dance, hovered on the outskirts. It was there the purser found him. Fitzgibbons beckoned him out of hearing of those who ringed the dance floor. "Who was this dame you were dancing with a little while ago?" he asked gravely. "I don't know why." "Do you know she was a steerage passenger?" "What of it?" asked Murphy, laughing. "You and I are a couple of Democrats." "I advise you to say you didn't know it," said the purser solemnly. "Then she gets all the blame." "Well, I knew it, and I'm damn glad I gave the child a good time for a little while." "That's too bad, Mr. Murphy. You're under arrest." Murphy stared at him blankly. "Are you serious?" "Yes, damn it. You brought up a cheap cabaret singer from the steerage and flaunted her in front of the young ladies in the first cabin. What's her name?" "Go to the devil and find out," growled the rambler. "Trouble is that this fellow Beckett complained to the skipper. The skipper told me to learn if you knew that she had no right up here. You admit you knew what she was. You will be confined to your cabin until we get to Panama. Captain's orders." "I won't stand for it." "You chump. The captain of a ship can hang you if he wants to. It won't be so bad. We'll be there in a few days. You'll have all your meals served in your room. About all you do is read books, and I'll send them down to you. Let me see the captain." "Take my advice and don't. He's an old so-and-so, and you're Irish. Talk up to him, and you'll wind up in the brig in irons. Any way to fix this?" "It's Beckett. He's a big shot, and the captain has orders to be nice to him. He don't give a damn about you, so you are the goat. Are you coming to your cabin, or have I got to send for the master-at-arms?" "I'll go. I'll sue the company." Fitzgibbon laughed. "You haven't a leg to stand on. We have a right to confine any passenger who makes himself objectionable in any way. In bringing this mole up here, you technically insulted everybody in the first cabin. Well, I'm glad I did. Let's go." 3 days later in the afternoon, the big ship steamed into the harbor of Balboa. Addison Francis Murphy had a partial view of the beautiful tropical harbor and entrance to the Panama Canal through his porthole. He heard the band playing up on the promenade deck. He glimpsed Navy planes flying low, circling the steamer like giant seagulls. He heard the shouts of passengers to friends on the government pier, cries of those below who had come to meet the ship. For 3 days the Rambler had been in a humor of a kind which boded ill for John C. Beckett and his lieutenant, Jack Slocum. The ship was fast to the dock, gangplank in position. Passengers were going ashore. Murphy tried his cabin door. It was locked. He rang for the steward, but nobody came. All the stewards were busy carrying hand luggage ashore. Time passed. He saw the passengers on the pier. He saw them meeting their friends. Unable to see the steerage gangway, he obtained no sight of Miss O'Brien and her fellow actresses. But he did observe Miss Darcy, welcomed by an old gentleman in the uniform of a general in the United States Army. She introduced John C. Beckett to the general, then shook hands with Beckett and went off on the arm of the soldier. Beckett moved out of view. The throng on the pier lessened. Motor cars and horse vehicles were departing with the passengers. Murphy kept ringing his bell but continued to get no reply. Finally, the pier was deserted. At the end of 2 hours, the steward unlocked his door. Purser Fitzgibbons was at his elbow, grinning like a Cheshire cat. "I bet you're sore," he remarked. "I certainly am. Why wasn't I turned loose when we docked? What right have you to keep me imprisoned?" The purser dismissed the steward and sat down on Murphy's bed. "What's this Beckett got against you?" he asked curiously. Murphy hesitated. "Why?" he inquired. "It was all right to report you for bringing one of those tough babies from the steerage to the first cabin dance. You should have been reported. But he asked the old man, as a favor to him, to hold you on board for a couple of hours after docking. How could that be a favor to him?" "I'll have to find out." "You're a funny egg," remarked Fitzgibbon. "You don't give the gals in first cabin a tumble. You bury your nose in the encyclopedia. Next thing we know, your pals is one of these those dimes from the hold. You got low taste. That's it?" "Listen, you thick Mick. I'm a newspaper man. I'm on the trail of a big story. I'm the correspondent of an important news service in Panama. You tell the captain that I wouldn't want to promise him, but I may be able to have him put on the beach for being an accessory in a major crime." "What you need is a drink," declared the purser with a hoarse laugh. "It's on me." "Okay, I'll have one. Has that job lot of actresses from the steerage gone ashore?" Murphy asked. "Yep. A special bus took him away. Slocum went with them. He didn't tell anybody in first cabin he was a theatrical manager, but I knew it, of course. You'll be surprised to know that Beckett is the boss of that troupe." "Aw, say, he wouldn't bother with a piking proposition like that. He's got a lot of dough, I know that." "Well, I'm leaving this ship here. I don't know Panama. Where do we meet for dinner? I'm buying." "Hotel Central at 7 o'clock. Ship sails at 5 a.m., so I'll have to leave you early, about 4. Murphy picked up his suitcase, refused to give it to the steward, who had been his jailer, forgot completely the small matter of tips, and went ashore. Beckett, Slocum, and the 32 blondes were mixed up in something that could bear investigating. A taxi rushed them through the American town of Ancon into the old city of Panama and drew up before the entrance to the U.S. consulate, but all doors were closed. It was 6 p.m. Dismissing the cab, he went into a saloon and made some inquiries. Yes, there was an American newspaper, the Panama Herald. He secured their address, took another cab, and arrived at the office of the paper, located in a tumbled-down building near the seawall. A man in white linen sat tapping leisurely upon a typewriter, only occupant of the city room. He leaned back when the Rambler entered. A thin man with a large brown mustache turned up at the corners. "How are you?" asked genially. "Got a piece for the paper?" "Name of Murphy. Opening an office for the Round World Press. Came in on the Delphin." "That's an item. I'm the city editor and head reporter. I just had an interview with Miss Vivian Darcy, guest of General Schuster in the Zone. Meet her on the trip?" "I exchanged a few words with her," said the Rambler, with a wry grin. "There was a big theatrical troupe on board, 32 girls. What theater are they going to play in?" "You mean a chorus of 32 girls? Man alive, the only real theater here is an opera house, and it's closed. No honky-tonk can employ as many girls as that. A dozen is the limit." "This is a big musical enterprise, I understand. Who's promoting it?" "Whoever is keeping it dark. There are only half a dozen men in Panama City who promote shows, and they're all pikers." "Ever hear of John C. Beckett?" "Nope." "Jack Slocum?" "Unknown to me." "They brought the girls down. They came over from Balboa in a special bus." The city editor grinned. "Good looking?" "Anyways, They're all blondes, said Murphy with an answering grin. Central Americans like blondes, but 32? We'll spend money for a group picture of them. That's news in this man's town. I'll telephone around. Make yourself at home. My name's Barnett. Used to work in Hartford. Came down here 20 years ago and went to hell. Got so I liked the tropics. He went into a phone booth and was busy for 10 minutes. He came back, looking perplexed. No showman knows anything about this troop, he said, and they are not at any of the hotels or boarding houses. The vanishing blondes, huh? Just what would these two fellows be able to do with all those women? Parnett laughed. Marry them to our leading citizens, if they are blonde enough. There's a good story in this. I know the town like a book, and I'll go out on it after dinner. Perhaps somebody plans to open up the opera house at that. Drop back here about 11 o'clock. I'll probably have some information for you. They shook hands, and Murphy took a cab to the Central Hotel, where he was dining with Purser Fitzgibbons. It was a large, typically Spanish structure, set on the edge of a spacious plaza, thickly populated with different people. He saw a number of persons whom he knew had been among the Delphian's passengers, but no sign of Beckett and Slocum. There was a story here. A crime of some sort was being committed, and it looked like he would make good with the round-world press from the start. The musical enterprise had seemed fishy from the first. Beckett had caused him to be confined to his cabin to keep him from getting a line on his game, and had had him detained on board long enough to get clear away with his strange cargo. Murphy grinned. He wouldn't be able to hide away 32 blondes very long in a country where blondes were as scarce as snake's teeth. "Paging Mr. Murphy," called a yellow bellboy. Murphy snapped his fingers, and the boy approached. "I'm Murphy." "A letter, senor." Part 3. Invitation to Sudden Death. The letter was on the stationery of the steamship company, and the Rambler sensed the contents before he tore it open. Fitzgibbons was unable to leave the ship and sent his regrets. As he folded the letter and put it in his pocket, a hand touched his shoulder. He looked up to observe a derisive smile upon the countenance of Mr. Jack Slocum. "Wise guy, huh? Had a taste of jail yourself, right?" "Short sentence, though," replied Murphy blandly. "No hard feelings, as you told me. Say, I'd like to see more of that O'Brien girl. Where is your troop stopping?" "Buy you a drink," suggested Slocum. "Why not? Planter's punch is a specialty. Let's get a table." The two mortal enemies sat down together, and Slocum ordered the drinks. "Beckett is a bad boy to monkey with," remarked Slocum. "I had to tell him what you said." "Did he work fast? I ask you." Murphy chuckled. "He worked fast. When does your show up and where?" "We'll put on operettas in the opera house. Beckett is going to get a subsidy from the government. That's under your hat." "Can any of them sing?" inquired Murphy. Slocum laughed. "The principals can sing. They haven't arrived yet. Coming down from New York. We're up against a delay, so we took the malls out to a cheap joint on the way to Old Panama Roadhouse. $1 a day per dame, boarding and lodgings. Drop out. Kate O'Brien is the best of the bunch." At that, he drew a scrap of paper from his pocket and scribbled an address. "Cost you a couple of bucks to get out there, so maybe it ain't worth it." "It was just an idea I had." Slocum downed his drink. "Got a date with a dame from the first cabin for dinner," he said. "No hard feelings, Murph, right?" "None whatsoever," the Rambler assured him blandly. He watched his retreating back sardonically. It was very probable that this address was a trap. If Beckett and Slocum had no objections to him knowing where the girls were lodged, why have him held on board ship until they were safely away? On the other hand, he knew that the troop had not been quartered in the city, thanks to the Panama Herald's man's inquiry. And he had read somewhere that these South American republics actually paid subsidies to theatrical companies. Not to an outfit like this, though. Was the game to display these blondes? Collect a subsidy and disappear, leaving the girls stranded? Not enough money in it for Beckett. It was quite likely that the company had been taken out of town and lodged in some cheap roadhouse, but it was not likely to be the place to which Slocum had kindly directed him. Just the same, Murphy knew he was going out there to have a look, and was perfectly well aware that he would be taking his life in his hands. Slocum would murder him with great satisfaction if he thought there would be no comeback. Not being a 100% idiot, he decided to have a talk with city editor Barnett before embarking upon this wild enterprise. After sampling chicken with Spanish rice, Murphy put in the time rambling through the streets of the town. There was a moon shining down, band playing in the plaza, crowds in the parks and on the main streets. Quickly leaving the business streets, he drifted down one narrow side street, up another. The buildings were mostly one story in height, and the inhabitants overflowed into the thoroughfares. Many homes had no windows, only a door like a barn door, which was wide open, and families went through the business of living in full view of passerby. At 11, he reported at the newspaper office to be informed by a young Spaniard in charge at the time that Barnett had phoned, and he had no information for Mr. Murphy and would not return to the office. Murphy showed the address Slocum had given him to the youth, who said, "I don't know the place, but there are quite a few joints out that way. Bad liquor and poisonous food. Stick to the town bars." 5 minutes later, the rambler was in a motor car headed for Casa Casalba, Bella Vista, Panama. In 5 more minutes, the car crossed the railroad tracks and was running through a large, fairly modern suburb, which seemed to be sound asleep. Shortly after, they were out of the region of street lights. The car was running over smooth macadam. If there were houses, they were invisible in the darkness. Unseen vegetation perfumed the warm air. The stars overhead glittered brightly but shed no light on the landscape. Murphy tried to pick out the Southern Cross but gave it up. He had tried to locate it on the ship and hadn't succeeded. He had no plan. It was possible that Slocum had sent him on a wild goose chase, perhaps to get him out of the way while something was pulled off in Panama. It was possible he wasn't rushing into a trap. It was not possible that Slocum sympathized with his feigned interest in the O'Brien girl. It was curious that Barnett had lost interest in the vanishing blondes. He had been keen about them when Murphy had left him at the newspaper office. Well, Barnett was a run-to-seed reporter. Perhaps he had been bribed. Half an hour passed, and the car turned into a dirt road. How much further, he demanded. 2-3 miles, senor. The Casa Casaba was a brick-and-plaster building built on 3 sides of a courtyard. It was 2 stories high with a flat roof. Its age must have been a couple of centuries, for originally it had been a hacienda. It had been abandoned a quarter of a century before by a half-Spanish, half-Indian named Juan Morales. An innkeeper who had secured the place, fixed it up, and opened it as a roadhouse. He had a notion that Panama would be filled with tourists because the Panama Canal had just been opened, and also because it lay between the city and the ruins of the old Panama destroyed by Morgan, the buccaneer, 3 centuries earlier. His enterprise failed, but he hung on there because he had no other place to go, and his son Juan took it over when he died, running a truck farm. He married a woman out of a dive in what they called the Coconut Grove in Panama City, who had other ideas for the place. It became a hideout for Panama lovers. That phase passed, and now it had degenerated into a cheap cantina with few customers. There were, however, 12 rooms with beds in them on the second floor, a large bar equipped with a nickel-in-the-slot piano, a bad-smelling restaurant, and an assortment of the cheapest sort of liquors. Juan finally gave up the ghost, closed the place, and moved into the city. On this night, however, it looked as if the dream of the old man had come true. The bar was brightly lighted. Female voices were lifted in song, not Spanish songs, but such ditties as Moon Over Miami. The old piano occasionally played a discordant American tune of 10 years' vintage, and the girl sang to its accompaniment. 2 waiters were serving beer to a strictly female patronage. In the courtyard was a large ancient motor bus with its side curtains down. The bar was on the left-hand wing of the Casa Casaba. The other wing was dark, but there was a light in a window on the ground floor of the center wing. A motor car blew its horn 3 times and then rolled into the courtyard. A door in the center wing opened and a man peered out. "It's Beckett," he called. "We're in here, John." John C. Beckett, wearing black evening clothes with a Panama hat, got out of the car and approached the door. Slocum stepped back and ushered him into the lighted room. "Good evening, Frank," said Beckett cheerily. "Hello, Ramon." Frank was a huge man, wearing dirty white trousers, a dirty white shirt, open at the neck and which revealed a thick growth of black hair on his chest. He had black hair but light blue eyes, somehow out of place in a face tanned the color of sole leather. Ramon was a tall, lean Latin, good-looking save for a hard mouth and dressed in clean whites. "Where in hell have you been?" demanded Frank. "Rushing the dames off the boat at the Union Club?" Beckett poured himself a drink from the bottle of scotch on the table. "Just that," he said pleasantly. "Why not?" "We got important business," growled Frank. "Shut up," snapped Beckett. Few people would have suspected Beckett of being other than he appeared. A typical businessman with sporting inclinations. Athletic in build, he looked younger than his 45 years. His smile frank, open over his teeth, white and regular. "Murphy shown up?" he asked of Slocum. Nope. Think he'll come? Yes, said Slocum firmly. That guy ain't afraid of man or devil. I told you what he did in Baltimore. He'll show up. He smells a rat, said Frank. He'd better come, or we'll go after him. And when he comes, said the Spaniard softly, a knife right at this spot. He indicated his heart. We'll bury him in the old cemetery back there. Same tomb with old Juan Morales. Which sounds to me like a very good idea, said Slocum with relish. Beckett smiled. I have a better one, he said. But first, catch your rabbit. This fellow doesn't believe you gave him the location of this place out of friendship.
Nah, he knows it's a trap. But he's the kind of guy that walks into traps, and usually gets out.
What precautions have you taken?
Two men watching the road. They'll close in on him from behind.
Beckett poured himself another drink.
There is no way he could have learned about our plans. But that kind of fellow can make a guess fairly near the mark. Valdez says he told a reporter on a Panama paper named Barnett that you and I, Jack, aren't going to use these girls in show business.
Say, exclaimed Frank, if he's talked to this reporter, there will be questions asked when he don't show up tomorrow.
Diego Valdez has that reporter under his thumb, said Beckett. However,
that isn't important as it happens.
I've got something terrific, Jack. I'll tell you about it.
Slocum's eyes sparkled.
Oh, yeah?
It makes this deal a sideshow.
Look here, shouted Frank. This ain't no sideshow. I'm up to my neck in it. Don't you try any funny business, Beckett.
You're in on it, Frank Hogan, so shut up. You too, Ramon.
What do you mugs say to $500,000?
Nuts, growled Hogan.
We got 50,000 cinched. I'm no hog.
It fits in neatly with my plans. Ramon, go out and tell your men not to let Murphy see them, not to interfere with him. I want him to walk into the bar and make himself at home. That is, if he's fool enough to come.
Say, protested Slocum, you can't fool with Rambler Murphy. He's dynamite. Ramon's right. A knife between the ribs and a quick burial.
Beckett laughed contemptuously.
You've a grudge against him.
I'm going to make him useful. I need him in this new business.
Frank, the hairy man, got up and thumped the table.
Nothing doing, you damn dude, he bellowed.
What?
Oh, all right. For an automatic had appeared magically in Beckett's white hand and was pointed at the middle of the big man's chest. This is my show, he said through clenched teeth, and you play my way.
Give us an idea what it is, boss, pleaded Slocum.
Put up that rod. You can't blame Frank. You know what'll happen to him down there if his deal flops.
I'll tell you in good time.
There is no risk.
Ramon entered hastily.
A man's walking up the road alone, he said. Has a gray suit on.
That's him, exclaimed Slocum excitedly. If we let him get away...
Beckett's laugh was harsh.
He won't get away, he said confidently.
Part 4. The Dead Lie Long. The chauffeur pointed to lights in the distance.
There's the casa, señor. I thought maybe it was closed.
Murphy laughed at the naive remark. The chauffeur had unscrupulously taken him for this long drive under the impression that they would have to turn around and go back.
Joke's on you, he said.
Señor, I do not understand. You don't have to. When you get within half a mile, stop the car.
Si, señor.
Why not drive you to the entrance?
Stop here, he commanded a few minutes later.
Here's your $5.
I shall wait to take the señor back to Panama?
No, perhaps I won't go back.
Under his breath, he added, and there may be more truth and poetry in that.
The driver, still protesting, took his fare and turned the car around. Murphy stepped off the road and waited several minutes. Listening intently, finally, he continued on toward the roadhouse. Presently, two shadows came out of the fields and followed him at a distance of 100 yards. He was unaware of their presence, but he moved with extreme caution. When, within a short distance of the house, he listened incredulously, female voices were raised in song. A violent chorus was singing, "Be Still My Heart." Being almost certain that wherever the human sheep had been hidden, it would not be here, their presence was astonishing. A grin spread over his countenance. Why, the girls are whooping it up. Unconsciously, he quickened his steps. He was almost off guard. Lights were blazing from a row of windows in the left wing of the old building, throwing radiance upon the driveway. He swung off to the left, approaching the outside of the left wing. 4 windows on this side were lighted. The singing continued, some very dreadful voices in this chorus. It meant that Slocum and Beckett hadn't even bothered to try the voices of their chorus girls. Convinced that he was not observed, he crept up to the side of the building, stood on tiptoe beneath an uncurtained window, peered in.
Danny laughed aloud. There was nobody inside save the girls, two waiters and a bartender. Half a dozen pairs of the ex-steerage passengers were dancing, while the rest sat at tables, thumped beer mugs on the tabletops, and sang the waltz at the top of their lungs. Flushed with beer and excitement, the young women looked better than when sprawled around on the steerage benches. Suddenly he spied Kate O'Brien. She was sitting with a dark girl, legs crossed, hands folded across her knees, a somber expression on her pretty face. It decided Murphy. Slocum had told them the absolute truth. Kate O'Brien was where he had said she would be. Slocum had invited him to call. Slocum, a murderous crook, hated him, but if it were true that the ladies were waiting here until called for rehearsal at the opera house, it was unlikely that he would want trouble with a newspaper reporter whom he knew had a job in Panama. If it were not true, something would drop on Mr. Murphy, yet it was worth the risk of finding out. He boldly walked around the wing of the building, located the entrance on the courtyard side, opened the door, and stepped into the bar. The singing died instantly. The dancers stopped dancing. 32 pairs of eyes were fixed on him in astonishment. "My God, a man! It's the man that was on the ship! You got a knife, mister?" All of a sudden, Kate O'Brien was clinging to his arm. Tears were streaming down her cheeks. "You came," she breathed. "Say, am I glad to see you?" "Hello, Kate," he said, smiling. There was a burst of shrill laughter. They crowded round in a circle. The Rambler, whom women easily embarrassed, was the color of a ripe tomato. "You can't have him, Kate," said a buxom blonde stridently. "We'll take turns dancing with him." "Make him buy whiskey." "Well, they'll give us his beer," proposed another. "You dame scram," screamed Kate. "Mr. Murphy came to see me. I invited him. He's a particular friend of mine." "That right feller?" asked a new voice. "You bet," declared the Rambler. "Well, let them alone." "You bet you'll let us alone," said Kate fiercely. It was evident she dominated the others, probably by superior moral force, for they drifted away, although continuing to stare at him from all parts of the bar. A waiter appeared, asked his order. Murphy produced a $5 bill. His money was evaporating rapidly. "Beer all around," he commanded. He led Kate to a table in a corner. "Everything all right?" "I guess so. We have to sleep three in a bed. The beds are awful. The grub is worse than on the boat and has too much garlic in it. But they give us all the beer we want and told us to have a good time." "Slocum here?" "He looked in a couple of hours ago. I suppose he's around." "Where is your show going to play?" "We got to stay here for a week or so, and then the principals arrive and we move into Panama. This is an awful dump. When I couldn't locate you in the city, I was a bit worried." "Oh, I guess nothing worse can happen to us than getting hit with bum eggs when we open the show," she said with a slightly hysterical laugh. "Gee, I'm glad to see you, Mr. Murphy. You certainly treated me swell that night on the boat. I was kind of disappointed that I didn't see you anymore. They made a fuss about my taking you to the dance." "I'm awful sorry. I was afraid they would. Darn it. Here's Slocum." Slocum appeared at the door, observed Murphy, and came over, a broad smile on his face. "No matter how dumb they are, they can still catch fish," he said. "Right, Kate?" "No dirty cracks. I'm not afraid of you," she said fiercely. He sat down uninvited. "You must be stuck on the dame," he said to the Rambler. "If he is it any of your business?" she demanded. "Did I ask you over here?" "I told them where you were staying," he said cheerfully. "Now I get bawled out." She was full of contrition. "Oh, I didn't know that." "The drinks are on me," said the man, who had no hard feelings against the person who had sent him to jail for several years. "I'll chase these floozies off to bed first." "No more beer," he shouted. "You girls, hit the hay. You know your rooms. Go there." "How about lights?" demanded somebody. "There ain't any lamps in my room." "Use candles. The waiters will light you up with the lamps." "That goes for you, Kate." "But he's only just come." "Can't help it. Boss's orders." The girls were reluctantly filing out. Half a dozen bracket kerosene lamps lighted the bar. The waiters took two of them and led the way. Miss O'Brien lingered. "Am I going to see you tomorrow?" she asked anxiously. "Two scotch and sodas," called Slocum to the bartender. "None for you, Kate. Scram." She rose reluctantly. The bartender was preparing the drinks. "Good night," she said softly. Murphy felt a qualm. "If the poor kid is falling in love with me," he thought, "why, that's terrible." She walked slowly toward the exit beyond the bar into the corridor. Murphy watched her sadly. Slocum had his back turned. At the door, she swung about. She pointed to the bartender, made a gesture of lifting a drink in her hand, then shook her head violently.
"I get you. Good night," called the rambler.
"Get what?" asked Slocum, whirling around.
Murphy smiled. "She threw me a kiss."
"Oh, well, she ain't so bad.
Not my style."
"Every man to his taste," Murphy remarked sententiously. The bartender placed a drink in front of each man. Murphy reached over, took Slocum's drink, and placed his in front of Slocum.
"What's the idea?" inquired Jack.
"Good luck, that's all," said Murphy.
"Good luck yourself," replied Slocum, with an equally bland smile, and switched the drinks again.
The rambler sprang up. His right fist shot out. It struck the jailbird between the eyes, and its force was great enough to knock him and his chair over on the floor. Murphy made a swift rush for the door, but as he approached it, it flew open and three men blocked the exit. One was John C. Beckett. The second was a huge, heavily tanned, blue-eyed man, and the third was a Spaniard. Murphy charged them savagely. He shouldered Beckett out of the way, dropped Ramon with a right swing, and hit Frank in the stomach without the slightest effect upon the giant. Frank opened his arms and embraced the rambler. His hug was like a grizzly's. He raised Murphy off his feet, lifted him high in the air, and hurled him upon the floor. The rambler came up, but very groggy. Slocum was coming from the rear, a gun in his hand. Ramon was up brandishing a knife with an 8-inch blade. The huge right fist of Frank collided with the jaw of the dauntless but shaken reporter, and Murphy hit the floor again, lay still. Ramon lifted his knife, bent over. Beckett grasped his wrist.
"None of that," he snarled. "I need this guy. Carry him out."
The four men lifted the unconscious interloper and carried him into the courtyard.
"I tell you, he's dynamite," exclaimed Slocum. "For God's sake, boss, let me finish him off. I owe him plenty."
Beckett drew him to one side.
"I need him for the go-between," he whispered.
"Go-between for what? Are you crazy? We don't need a go-between."
"Oh, yes, we do. We're taking him with us, and we're sending him back."
"I suppose you know what you're talking about," muttered Slocum.
"We got him."
"What'll we do with him?" demanded Frank. Murphy, who was lying on the stone flagging, suddenly sat up.
"Hit him again and harder," commanded Beckett.
Frank closed his big right fist, drew it back, and let it go. It crashed against the right temple of the rambler, and he lay back on the flagging, out for a long period.
"Ramon, you said something about a tomb," said Beckett, smiling.
"Let's have a look at it."
The Spaniard looked startled and sighed.
"You mean, put him in the tomb of Juan Morales?"
"If it will hold him, he'll be safely out of the way until tomorrow night."
"Bury him alive," exclaimed Slocum.
"What? I'm for that."
"How far is the cemetery?" demanded John C. Beckett.
"About a couple of hundred yards.
Pick him up and let's look it over." Three fellows had arrived on the scene. Ramon gave an order in Spanish and they lifted Murphy upon their shoulders. He was heavy for the little men, so Frank lent a hand. The singular procession filed out of the courtyard and moved around the right wing of the Casa Casaba. They moved across a field of scrub grass through a broken place in a stone wall, and then the bearers began to mutter protest. An oath from Ramon silenced them. They had entered a private cemetery. It had been the burial place of the original owners of the hacienda. Not more than 40 persons were buried here, but there were half a dozen large tombs. Ramon stopped before the tomb of the late Juan Morales, and the bearers let the still unconscious Murphy drop upon the ground. Beckett went forward and lighted a match. It was a brick and plaster tomb, but much of the plaster coating had fallen off. There was a big iron door. The structure was about 5 feet high by 8 feet square. A rusty padlock was on the door.
"It ought to hold him," remarked Beckett.
"Break this padlock. I'll leave somebody to stand on watch, of course." More protests came from the peons, who crossed themselves. "Violation of a tomb." Slocum examined the padlock, produced a revolver, inserted the barrel in the house, used leverage, and it opened easily. The iron door swung back with a clang and whining of rusty hinges. There were moans of terrors from the peons, but no ghost emerged.
"Toss him in," commanded Beckett.
"Wait." He lighted a match, stepped inside the door of the tomb, and looked around. Three stone coffins were piled one upon another at one side of the interior. The other side was empty.
"All right," he reported. "It ought to hold the lug."
Frank and Slocum carried Murphy in and laid him on the stone floor. The Spaniards would not have entered, even if threatened with death. They emerged, the door was closed, and the broken hasp of the padlock passed through the staple. "No chance of his getting out," stated Beckett. "But put two of those guys on guard here, Ramon. I know they don't like cemeteries. See if this will cheer them up." He produced two $10 bills, and the objections of the natives were stilled. "Another drink and we'll all turn in," said Beckett cheerfully, "and I'll tell you fellows what it's all about." "I certainly want to know," declared Frank. They returned to the room and Slocum filled the glasses. "We have a perfect setup for a snatch," declared Beckett, "and the easiest snatch on record." He seemed very confident about it, too. "What do you mean?" demanded Frank. "At 9 tomorrow night, the Guadalupe leaves Panama Harbor. She'll be off Starrett at 10, looking for the lights from our launch." "I made the arrangements," declared Frank. "I ought to know. Tomorrow afternoon, Vivian Darcy, daughter of William Darcy, the Copper King, goes out to see the ruins of old Panama with General Schuster and his daughter, and yours truly. I'll arrange things so we don't get there until dusk. I'll get her away from the old folks. She rather likes me. Jack will be waiting with a car. You know, the jungle grows right up almost over the ruins. You can get 50 feet away from people and lose them. I'll give her the needle, get her into Jack's car, and we take 33 girls instead of 32. "And then what?" demanded Frank. "There's radios, airplanes. There'll be hell to pay. The general will hunt for us. He won't leave for a couple of hours. It will be 10 o'clock before he gets to Panama. He'll send searching parties back and accompany them. There are old wells, trapdoors, secret passages in the old castles. We might have fallen through into a pit. They'll search all night. The Guadalupe has sailed before the loss of Miss Darcy and myself was reported. Nobody in the ship will know that she isn't one of the girls. The sick one, it's a cinch. And her old man will pay $500,000 for her." Frank drew a long breath. "It's a great idea," he said. "I suppose we can get away with it." "You'll be suspected," John warned Slocum. "If they look you up, your record ain't so sweet. You can never go back to the USA." Beckett laughed. "I can't, anyway. I haven't told you, but the Federals are after me for an affair in Kansas City." "How do you expect to use that guy in the tomb?" demanded Frank. "We take him with us. We'll send him back by plane, land him in Panama. He goes to General Schuster, tells him that the ransom money is to be sent in English pounds to Pedro Dominguez in Caracoa, Colombia, with authority to deliver to the people who bring Miss Darcy to his office. If the directions are given out, if there's anything phony, they will never see the girl again. This isn't like an American snatch. They can't do business with the authorities down there. Frank's the authorities. Ain't you, Frank?" "I can make him jump through," said Frank complacently. Slocum scowled. "It lets Murphy out, though. I don't like that." "You damn fool. Don't jug him. We won't make any restrictions regarding Murphy. When they pay the money and get the girls back, they'll give him 20 years for kidnapping." Slocum smiled with satisfaction. "That's right. Never thought of that. Let's have a drink to Murphy, doing a 20-year stretch." Beckett rose. He crossed the room on tiptoe while the others gazed at him in surprise. There was a door which gave directly upon the patio and one which opened into the corridor that ran around the house. Beckett suddenly flung the inner door open. A girl stood there. The bright light dazzled her. Fright petrified her. She stood, eyes wide, her right fist pressed against her mouth. "Why, you, he sputtered and drove his fist viciously against the little chin of Kate O'Brien. The girl crumpled up and fell in a still heap upon the floor of the corridor. "Listening," snarled Slocum. "Well, let's break her bloody neck." "Yeah," shouted Frank. "I suppose you'd tear up a couple of $1,000. Jack, whose right foot had been drawn back to kick the unconscious young woman, hesitated. "That's right," he said. "But this is Murphy's gal, boss, and she probably got it all. She tipped him to the Mickey Finn I was preparing to feed him. That's why he slugged me and tried to lam it." "Why isn't she in her room?" demanded Beckett sharply. "We pulled all the boys to go to Murphy's funeral," said Jack. "Nobody was watching the second floor." Beckett shrugged his shoulder. "We need her in our business," he said. "Tie her up and stick her in a closet until we're ready to pull out tomorrow night. When we're aboard the Guadalupe, she can talk her head off if she likes. Not a bad-looking filly," he gazed down upon her dispassionately. "The best of the lot, says I," declared Frank. "She'll be the belle of the oil fields. You hadn't ought to have hit her so hard, Beckett." "Bah. She had it coming. You and Ramon, rope and gag her and stick her in some place you can lock up." Part 5. Man into Mole. Rambler Murphy was coming too slowly. He had taken fearful punishment, was weak, groggy, but he didn't have any broken bones. He lay on the stone floor. He sat up, felt in his pockets, found they hadn't frisked him. He had his wallet, watch, papers of matches, and small penknife. He got shakily on his feet, then bumped his head against the low stone roof. He scratched the match. It flared. Then, as he saw where he was, he dropped the match in consternation. He was in a tomb, buried alive. Coffins were piled up there. This was a very old tomb. Some cemetery in the vicinity of the Casa Casaba. He couldn't have been unconscious long, so this place couldn't be very far from the house. He was not afraid of the ancient dead and those stone coffins, but he did not relish the idea of being locked up with them. His hair was standing on end. His body was covered with goose pimples. He quickly got over that, faced a real horror. A tomb in an old cemetery, in a remote spot like that, where the Casa Casaba was located, would be an ideal place in which to dispose of a person. Nobody was going to open an old tomb. Unless released, or able to break out, he might remain here forever. This could not be an underground vault. There was plenty of fresh air. He lighted another match, located the iron door, drew back and hurled himself against it. A dull metallic clank resounded, but the door held solidly. He ran his fingers around the door's edge. There was perhaps a quarter of an inch space through which the air gained entrance. He might starve to death, but wouldn't die of suffocation. The clang of the tomb's door reverberated upon the night air, reaching the ears of the two peons guarding the living dead. They listened, looked at each other, and with one accord took to their heels. Probably this was the man they had thrust into the tomb, but he might have died and his ghost was stirring. A ghost could get out of a tomb. They didn't care to meet it. The tomb was no longer guarded, but this did the rumbler no good, inasmuch as he was alive and could not pass through solid substances. He lighted another match, studying the situation. The tomb had been built of brick and was covered with plaster. Patches of the plaster had fallen away, revealing the bricks. Since he couldn't budge the door, he must see what he could do about the walls. The cement between the bricks was hard in some places, powder-like in others. He opened his penknife, attacking the cement. It was tough going, but at the end of several hours he had three bricks out. It revealed another layer of brick, however, and the cement on these had been protected from the action of air over a couple of centuries was solid as a rock. In the end, the rambler lay down on the stone floor, and being exhausted was able to fall immediately asleep. The clanging of the door wakened him. Sunlight was pouring in, and Slocum, backed by two other men, was peering in at him. "Hello, Murph. How's tricks?" demanded Slocum. He had an automatic in his right hand, which prevented the rambler from plunging at him. Murphy growled. "Going to let me starve to death in here?" "Sure, why not?" replied Slocum. "Say, I had to half beat the life out of your girlfriend. She was listening at doors. Know where she's going? Down to the new oil region on the west coast of Colombia. Thousands of men down there and no women except Indians. You can imagine how those boys will go for blondes." Murphy, who was crouching, sprang at him despite the menace of the gun, but Slocum stepped back, slammed the iron door, and Murphy crashed against it. He heard the fellow's laugh. "Just look in to see if you're okay," he called. "This is worse than any jail, right, Murph?" Then Slocum departed. Murphy sat on his haunches and gazed solidly at the three stone boxes in which bodies had been placed long, long ago. There was no charnel odor in this tomb. Flesh had long since departed from the bones in the coffin. A dim light in the tomb came from the narrow space above, below, and at the sides of the door. They intended to bury him here permanently, since they hadn't the trouble to give him food and drink. Nobody in Panama knew him. Nobody would come to look for him. He examined the walls again. They were a foot and a half thick, judging from an inspection of the doorframe, and the door, though rusty, was solid. He hurled himself against it to try the hinges, but they didn't give in the slightest degree. He came as near to despair as a man of his type was apt to come. He gazed stolidly at the floor. It wasn't stone, but Spanish tiles. Tiles might be broken. He looked around for a weapon, but there was none. He rose, inspecting the top coffin. It was a stone slab, and laid on, not fastened with hinges. With a shudder, he lifted it. It weighed 50 pounds. He wasn't able to refrain from gazing within. A skull grinned up at him. He took the heavy slab, upended it, and dropped it upon a tile. It did not break the tile. The slab was almost as tall as the tomb, and he could not wield it effectively. He let it fall flat on the floor, and it broke neatly in the middle. Now he had something. He moved toward the back of the tomb, and with his 3-foot weapon attacked another tile. At the third blow, the tile cracked. In 10 minutes, he had it broken in a dozen places. Dropping the slab, he squatted and endeavored to lift out the broken tile with his fingers. It was slow, discouraging work, but he finally pried loose a piece 3 inches in diameter, about an inch thick. Beneath was earth, hard-packed sandy soil. Murphy was getting excited. In 15 minutes, he had removed the entire tile. Scooping out earth with his hand, he burrowed under the neighboring tile, succeeded in inserting the edge of the stone slab, and easily lifted out the tile. He laughed aloud.
If they didn't catch him at it, he was going to get out. At the end of 2 hours, he had removed a floor space 3 feet square and now attacked the hardest part of the job. With nothing but hands and penknife, he had to dig a tunnel under the rear wall up into the open air. It was slow but painful labor. It became horribly hot in the tomb as the terrible sun of early afternoon in Panama got in the job. Murphy was just perspiring from every pore but making progress. When he had dug a hole a foot and a half deep, he had an incredible piece of luck. He came upon a buried conch shell. Now he had a fair substitute for a scoop. He could lift a pound of earth at a time with it, and the sharp edge of the shell cut into the ground like the blade of a shovel. It was dark when he reached the bottom of the wall, which had been sunk 2 feet deep into the ground, but that was so much better as he could get away under cover of night. Hours passed, but the time came when the human mole came up out of a hole and stood up on the surface. His clothing was torn, he was exhausted, but triumphant. Now, how far was he from Casa Casaba? He couldn't locate it. He had no notion in which direction to proceed to get anywhere. However, the farther he got from his tomb, the better. He started to walk. He was ravenously hungry, and suddenly a dark building loomed up ahead of him. He approached it cautiously, identifying it. It was the Casa Casaba, but it was dark. Not a light anywhere. He crept along the wall of the house, peered into the courtyard. The moon came from behind a cloud, and he saw that the big bus and the motor car, which had been there the night before, were gone. So they had moved after burying him alive. He swore softly but savagely. With extreme care, he ventured into the courtyard. He crossed to the bar, peered by a window, empty and abandoned. He became aware that he was ravenously hungry and would take any risk for food. The door was open. He entered, felt his way to the bar. Lighting a match, he hunted on the shelves beneath the bar and found crackers, stale bread, and cheese. There was beer in bottles. Murphy feasted. When the inner man was satisfied, he was able to consider the situation. Why had the place been abandoned? Not on his account. They considered him safe, where they had put him. What did it mean? Moving a multitude of women around was a big job, and probably a costly one. Exactly what was their game? The quicker he got back to Panama, the better. He had money enough, thanks to their consideration in not robbing him. No doubt they had intended to do that at their leisure, to hire an automobile at some village to take him into the city. He rose. He didn't feel tired now, despite his superhuman exertions during the day and early evening. He left the Casa Casaba and started briskly down the driveway. He reached the road by which he had come, started along it. There wasn't a pinpoint of light visible to indicate a habitation, but the moon was shining and showed him his way. After he had walked a mile, he saw, some distance ahead, a female form in the road, somebody from whom he could ask directions. He hesitated, then hastened his pace, gained on her rapidly. 50 feet behind, he shouted, "Hello there!" To his astonishment, the woman broke into a run. He had to talk to her. He ran after her. She rushed off the roadway and plunged into thick bush. He heard her crashing through shrubbery. "I won't hurt you," he shouted. "I just want to ask how to get to Panama." He heard a scream. The bushes parted, and the girl rushed toward him. "Oh, Mr. Murphy," she cried. "Oh, I'm so glad." Then she fell sobbing into his arms. "Well, I'm damned," he exclaimed. "Where did you come from? What's happened? Where's everybody?" But Kate O'Brien was sobbing hysterically, and it took several minutes to soothe her. "They were going to take you with them. They were going to put you in jail for 20 years, she moaned. "Oh, I'm so glad." "Come on, kid. Everything's all right. Where are they?" "They've gone," she said with a sigh. "Excuse me for being such a fool, but you ain't got no idea what I've been through." "Where have they gone?" "They're going on a ship. I don't know where. They're going to take you with them. They kidnapped a girl they're going to get $500,000 for, and you are going to be the go-between and go to jail for 20 years. He patted her shoulder. "Calm down, kid. What you say doesn't add up right. I'm here, aren't I? And you're here. How long ago did the outfit pull out?" "About 3/4 of an hour, she said, rubbing her eyes with her fists. "How does it happen you didn't go with them?" "Because I listened last night and heard them talking. You see, I knew you had a fight with them, and I was afraid they'd hurt you. When they came back, I hadn't gone to my room. I saw a light on the ground floor and listened at the door of the room to find out what happened to you." "Why, you brave kid." "And that's how I learned they were taking us on a ship to a place called Colombia. It's a country. It's south anyway, on a ship called the Guadalupe or something like that. And they had you a prisoner and were going to send you back when they got the Darcy girl down there and..." "Miss Darcy," exclaimed. "They've kidnapped her? Are you sure?"
Sure, I saw her. They brought her to that house up there. They took her off in the bus with the other girls. His mind was turning somersaults. Of course. Vivian Darcy, the Copper King's daughter. What a prize. They were going to the west coast of Colombia, a vast region so far from Bogota, the capital that was almost without law and authority. And Slocum, who expected the Rambler to die in that tomb, told him what would happen down there to Kate O'Brien. White slavery it was, working out of Panama, no longer strictly supervised by Uncle Sam, to the new oil regions of western Colombia. How did you get away? He asked gently. She told him what had happened. They had left her in that closet and released her only for an hour before departure. Frank, the big man, had taken her into the bar, where the other girls were already assembled, told her to keep her mouth shut or she'd get her head beaten off, and left her. A few minutes later, a car had driven into the courtyard, and Kate, through a window, saw Beckett and Slocum lifting out a young woman who seemed unconscious. They carried her to the bus, placed her in it. Slocum had gotten in with her. Beckett had then reappeared and made an announcement. He told the girls that they were going to be lodged in a good hotel in Panama City and were leaving at once. Their scanty luggage was already being placed on the top of the bus. Kate had no friends in the crowd, and the rest were all delighted at the transfer. Only Kate knew where they were really going. They moved in a mob into the courtyard, were lined up alongside the bus and counted by one of the Spaniards with a flashlight. Kate was in a state of mortal terror. Everything was over for her if she got into that bus. In the confusion and darkness, she stooped, slipped underneath the bus, came out on the other side, and sped across the courtyard. Her escape was not noticed. She reached the corner of the building without being observed by the gang herding the girls into the bus. She got a safe distance from the place and lay flat on the ground. Shortly afterward, the bus departed, was followed by the car, which had been used to kidnap Miss Darcy, and another car. The place had been abandoned. So I started to walk to Panama or somewhere, she finished. A ship called the Guadalupe, he said thoughtfully. Maybe we can have her held at Panama. What time does she sail? I think they said at 9 o'clock. If we could get to a place with a telephone, what time is it now? I don't know. My watch has stopped. Forgot to wind it this morning. I had other things on my mind, he said grimly. But they ain't going on board at Panama. It stops for them at a place called Sterrett or something like that, and they go out in a launch. That's at 10 o'clock. And it must be 8. We're miles and miles from anywhere. Come on, let's walk. Part 6. Slugs for Snatchers. He set off after dragging her at a stiff pace. He wasn't even sure he was going in the direction of Panama, but in a crisis like this, he couldn't stand still. Familiar as he was with criminal ingenuity, this setup was one to awaken his admiration. First, get this herd of ignorant girls out of the United States and land them in a foreign country under false pretenses, then rush them under cover of darkness on board some tramp which would transport them to a place where the law wouldn't be interested in their fate. It was a crime with no possibility of a kickback. White slavery made easy. But endeavoring to get Miss Darcy down there with them was not so easy. Her kidnapping would make a rumpus. The radio would broadcast the alarms. Warships from the canal zone would search all ships if it were known that she had been kidnapped. But let a day or two elapse before her disappearance was discovered, and the Guadalupe would land her and the other human freight at some point in Colombia before a warship could overtake and search that ship. The only person who might betray the plan was Kate, and they assumed that she was on the bus and would later be safely on the Guadalupe. Beckett had rightly assumed that if he got Miss Darcy into the interior of Colombia, her father would have to pay to get her back. It was a country where G-men would not be welcome. Lights ahead. My feet hurt, protested Kate. You walk too fast. Can't help it, he said grimly. I'll go on ahead if you like. No, don't leave me. He took her arm again and half carried her along. In 10 minutes, they entered a small town. 6 or 8 houses sprawled by the roadside and a gas station. There was a native boy sitting on the ground outside the station shack, and Murphy addressed him. Telephone in this town, he asked. No, sir, no telephone. Do you know a place called Sterrett? No, sir, no, I don't, he hesitated. You mean Starrett, maybe? That's it. Where is it? He made a gesture with his arm. About 5 or 6 miles on the coast. Any cars to rent? No, sir, no cars. What's that one there? He pointed to an open Ford parked back of the shack. That'm the boss's car. What time is it? You certainly ask lots of questions, boss, said the boy, displaying 2 rows of enormous white teeth. Murphy drew forth one of his 2 remaining bills, a $5 bill. You can take me there and back in an hour, can't you? $5?
I reckon I could shut up for that $5, said the boy. He leaped to his feet and glanced into the shack.
5 minutes past nine, he said.
Come on, folks.
Kate and the Rambler piled into the car, and Murphy realized that he was very tired. Kate almost collapsed on the seat.
Is Starrett a big place? He asked the driver as the car started.
No, Saw, just a little place.
Any telephones there?
I reckon there is, Saw.
The car left the boulevard and started over a road across town. It creaked, groaned, and didn't do better than 50 miles an hour. There was very little time, but the road grew better, the car traveled faster, and in about 16 or 18 minutes the lights of Starrett appeared.
Is there a police station at Starrett? He demanded.
No, Saw. They don't need no policeman.
What are you going to do? She demanded.
Stop them from getting on the ship.
How?
Somehow.
Be still, I want to think.
They came abruptly upon the waterfront. Starrett consisted of a row of one-story buildings along the beach. There was a small pier, a few bathhouses, and that was all.
Stop. Here's your money, said Murphy, and leaped out.
It must be close to 9:30. That arrived at the upper end of the beach. The street was deserted, but there were still bright lights in a half dozen places.
You stay here, he said curtly to Kate. I'm going to be busy.
She grasped his arm. You can't stop them. They'll kill you, she protested.
I'll take no risks, he lied. You do as I say.
All right, she meekly agreed. He left her and walked in the direction of the pier. There was a street leading in then from the pier. As he looked into it, he saw the dim outline of a bus parked 100 yards up. He looked at the pier and saw a large launch tied up there. There were no other craft visible. He crossed the street and came to a cantina into which he glanced cautiously. There were two or three natives inside, but none of Beckett's gang. They would be guarding the bus.
Have you a telephone? He hopelessly asked the bartender.
To surprise, the man pointed to an inner room. Joyfully, he went in, closed the door, and called the operator.
Connect me with the U.S. Army headquarters at Ancon.
He dropped 25 cents into the machine. In a minute, he had the connection.
This is Murphy of the Round World Press in Panama, he said.
Do you know that Miss Vivian Darcy has been kidnapped?
What?
Just a minute. Hold the line.
Somebody else came on the line.
Captain Pope speaking. You're a newspaper man named Murphy?
Well, Miss Darcy hasn't been kidnapped. She's lost somewhere in the ruins of old Panama. Searching parties are looking for her now.
Listen, Captain Pope. At 10 o'clock, Miss Darcy will be taken on board a ship bound for Colombia with 32 other girls brought down yesterday from San Francisco on the Delphin. White slavery. They intend to get $500,000 ransom for Miss Darcy when they have her in Colombia.
Wait a minute. No time. The girls are here in a big motor bus guarded by the slavers, a place called Starrett. They will take them out to the Guadalupe in a launch at 10 o'clock.
My God, man, it's 9:30 now.
How soon can you get here?
It's 10 miles out.
Half an hour. I'll send a bunch of army officers immediately, but they'll be aboard before we get there.
I'll try to detain them. Goodbye.
Help is coming, but it might arrive too late.
Murphy went out upon the street. He was unarmed. If he approached the bus, he knew what would happen. What in the devil was he to do?
His eyes rested on the launch. Too dark to see who was in it, but undoubtedly somebody was on board.
He walked 100 yards along the beach, stripped to his shirt and shorts, kicked off his shoes and stockings, and went into the water. He swam out beyond the pier. The moon was shining, but the launch was in the shadows, which is good. He swam swiftly but noiselessly. Keeping out of sight of the launch, he approached the pier, swam underneath it, close to the side of the motor craft. Its gunwale was too high to reach, a disappointment. A roller threw him against the barnacle-covered pile, and he struck a spike. There were spikes sticking out of the pile, one of the supports of the pier. He got his feet on one, found another higher one, and laid hands on the gunwale of the launch. Looking seaward, he spied the lights of a ship standing in. Looking shoreward, the outline of a man smoking a pipe up near the bow was invisible. His back was turned. In a moment, Murphy was on board the launch. A monkey wrench lay beside the engine in the center of the craft. He picked it up. The boatman heard a noise, turned and saw the intruder. He shouted something in Spanish, and then the Rambler plunged at him. The man thrust his hand in his pocket and pulled out a revolver. He fired one shot, and the bullet whined its way past Murphy's right ear. Immediately after that, the monkey wrench collided with the top of the man's head, and he went down. The Rambler picked up the revolver, fished the fellow's pockets for cartridges. He found the box contained 50. He broke the gun, ejecting and replacing the spent cartridge. The bus rolled down to the beach, followed by two motor cars. A man jumped out and came running to the pier.
"What's the matter there?" he shouted.
Murphy was trying to cast off the line,
but the knot was a Spanish knot, which resisted his inexperienced fingers. The fellow was so big he must be the one who had felled him in the bar. "Jose! What's the matter?" he bellowed. Murphy took careful aim and shot him in the right leg. He went to the ground, his weapon flying from his hand and falling into the water. Murphy was working at the knot again. If he only had a knife. He stooped over the man he had knocked out, but he didn't have a knife. Three or four men were approaching. "Look out!" bellowed the wounded Frank. "Somebody fired on me." Those approaching spread out and bent over, but continued to advance. Murph recognized both Beckett and Jack Slocum. If he could cut the rope, the boat would drift out into the harbor and everything would take care of itself. Slocum fired and immediately dropped flat. The bullet hit the bow of the launch. Somebody far over the right fired, and the bullet came within an inch of ending the career of Rambler Murphy. He had been standing upright to watch the pier, the floor of which was on the level with his chin, and he had to drop down behind the bulwark of the launch. He heard the tramp of feet on the pier. He straightened up, fired, and hit a man in the chest, a Spaniard by the look of him. A second man, Slocum, dropped flat. A bullet from the fellow at the right. Murphy could not stoop for shelter now. If they got over him on the pier, it was the end. He kept a watchful eye on the pier, but did not forget the man at the right on the shore, who was about 50 yards distant. The fellow made the mistake of getting up, and Murphy winged him in the right shoulder. He fired a shot at Slocum, who was crawling along the pier, missed, but stopped his progress. And then there was a shout from Beckett, who was well up the beach. "Quit firing!" cried. "You in the boat! Who are you? What do you want?" A voice from the tomb called Murphy loudly. "I don't want a damn thing. Keep back. You can't have this launch." "Murphy," called Beckett, "you can't hold us off. You'll get your brains blown out. Come out of there and we'll let you go free." Whack! Murphy had fired at the head of Slocum, who had reached the edge of the wharf and dared to thrust his head and right arm over. He was only 30 feet away, and his bullet left his gun almost simultaneously with that of Murphy's. But Murphy's bullet hit him in the side of the head. He was finished. There had been 7 in all, not counting the boatmen. The Rambler had wounded 3 and killed 1. He reloaded his revolver. He became aware of loud screams from the bus, and the population of the village was waking. Up the beach and down at a safe distance, crowds were assembling. "How would you like to make 5 grand?" cried Beckett. He was out of the range of Murphy's vision. "Go to the devil," Murphy bellowed back. And then something very heavy descended upon him from the pier and bore him to the bottom of the boat. Ramon had followed Murphy's method. He had gone into the water on the far side of the pier, swum to the end, climbed upon the pier, and crept down in the rear of the fighting Irishman. Crouching on the platform, he had seized the moment when Beckett was trying to parley to jump upon the head of the man blocking the expedition. It would have been the end of Rambler Murphy, save for a fortunate accident. As the pair went down, Ramon's forehead came into violent contact with one of the handles of the steering wheel, and the knife in his hand clattered to the deck. Murphy found an unconscious enemy on top of him, threw him off, and was up in time to Dieter Beckett, who had rushed down the pier firing wildly. Beckett dropped flat, and Murphy, grasping the knife, cut the rope he had been unable to unfasten. The bow of the launch swung wide, but there was a line at the stern. He plunged in that direction and drew 2 or 3 shots, which missed. The second line was cut, and the tide was dragging the launch out into the bay. Murphy lay flat and contented in the bottom, and the cries of rage from the survivors ashore was music to his ears. The original boatman was conscious and sitting up now, but the Rambler's revolver kept him quiet. Ramon was still out. A steamer was drifting along a couple of miles out, her signals like twinkling stars. Her captor wanted his passengers to hurry. Then came honking of horns, and headlights were visible on the street, leading from the pier. In a few seconds, 6 motor cars reached the beach, and men were springing out of them. There were men in uniform and men in evening dress, and they surrounded the bus, puzzled as to what to do. Then a young woman appeared among them and told them. "Let's go," said Murphy to the boatman. "Start the engine. Back to the pier." As Murphy came ashore, an American army captain grasped both his hands. "I'm Pope," he said. "You were all there, sir. General, this is Mr. Murphy. General Schuster is Miss Darcy's uncle." The gray-haired general didn't shake hands. He embraced the Rambler. And when he released him, a very beautiful but rather pale young woman stood in front of him. "Will you shake hands?" she asked. "I was hateful to you on the ship. But that awful Mr. Beckett had told me dreadful things about you. I can't express myself. I know what you've done for me, for no reason. You didn't even like me." "I thought you were swell," said Rambler Murphy. "We had no notion it was a kidnapping," the general told him. "We thought Vivian and Mr. Beckett had fallen into a pit in the castle at Old Panama. We were searching there when your message was relayed to me. I assure you, her father will know how to thank you, sir." "Miss O'Brien," called the Rambler. Kate came forward timidly. "I want to introduce you all to Miss O'Brien," he said. "Miss Darcy, Miss O'Brien is one of the girls brought down from San Francisco to appear in Panama in a musical comedy. Actually, it was a plot to take the young woman down to Colombia on that steamer waiting there. Miss O'Brien became suspicious and overheard Beckett Slocum and others planning to kidnap you and take you along for ransom. She escaped from the place. I encountered her walking back to Panama. I knew nothing whatever about the plot against you. You owe your gratitude to Miss O'Brien." Miss Darcy threw her arms around Kate and kissed her. "I thank you so much," she said, and burst into tears. "Captain Popeloff, you didn't do a damn thing, Murphy, did you?" An hour later, the Rambler was banging a typewriter in the cable office, shooting to the Round World Press Association in New York an exclusive story of the advantage taken of the new setup in Panama by American white slavers. Accompanying the story was a request for $500 for the expenses of opening the new office. Before he had finished the last take, the first part of the story had reached New York, and a highly congratulatory message had come in from his boss, Mr. J. Wallace. Even more welcome was an order for the cash. The Rambler was in funds again. The smooth crook, John C. Beckett, and his surviving accomplices were speedily tried in the Panama courts and sentenced to life imprisonment. A few days after the trial had concluded, Murphy, Miss Darcy, General Schuster, and a group of army officers put Miss O'Brien aboard the steamer for San Francisco. Kate was dressed as became a young lady who had now found grateful friends. "Will you kiss me goodbye?" she asked Murphy. He kissed her shamefaced because the others were watching them. Kate burst into tears. Miss Darcy went down the gangplank, her arm inside that of Murphy's. "Are you in love with her?" she asked. "You kissed her." "That was a goodbye," he said, much embarrassed. "Why, I'll kiss you goodbye when you sail for New York after tomorrow, if you'll let me." "I'll let you." "Didn't you save my life?" she exclaimed. "But I'm not going to New York day after tomorrow." "You're not?" "I've decided to remain in the zone for a month or two," she said. "Aren't you glad?" Murphy looked troubled. "Why, sure." "And we'll see a lot of each other." "Why, sure," he said, more troubled. "You bet." "Come, Vivian," called the general. The Rambler put her in the general's car and waved goodbye as it rolled away. Kate was a fine girl, and Vivian was a very fine girl. She had practically told him she was remaining on his account. She was rich as mud, and whoever married her would not have to worry about the future. He drove into the city, went into his office, sat down, and stared at the wall. He reached for a cablegram blank. He chewed the end of the pencil and wrote a message to the Round World Press. "Send down a new boy, sailing for New York tomorrow night. No action down here. Murphy." That made him feel better. "She certainly is a grand girl," he muttered. "So, it's time for me to ramble."